Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the first meeting of the year 2021, and it's the meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. My name is Janice Bellucci, and I am the Executive Director as well as the founder of this organization. So I'm happy to welcome you. I'm happy to wish you a happy new year. Certainly started out in a very interesting fashion. And folks, I want to remind everybody, because every once in a while somebody gets on the line and this is their first meeting. So let me introduce myself a little more fully. I am Janice Bellucci. I am Executive Director, and I'm also a civil rights attorney. And I, as Executive Director, answer many phone calls and emails that are sent to the organization. With me today is Chance Oberstein. And Chance, do you want to introduce yourself, please?
My name is Chance Oberstein. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I'm also president of the organization, and welcome and good morning.
Thank you, Chance. As far as the organization, we are a nonprofit organization. We're incorporated in the state of California, and we've been recognized as a nonprofit both by the IRS and also by the state equivalent here in California. As such, we are a 501c4, if anybody's interested in our IRS code designation. And that's important because as a 501c4, we can advocate, and that's exactly what we do. We're advocates. Chance and I advocate in the courtroom. We, as an organization, also advocate here in the state legislature and the state capitol. And we also spend a lot of time educating. And quite frankly, these monthly meetings that we have on the phone are a form of education. So Chance and I are both practicing attorneys, and we are here not to give people legal advice on the phone and on this call, which, by the way, is recorded. So please remember that this meeting, this entire meeting, is recorded. And so when you're called upon, you may identify yourself in any way that you want, but please remember that it's recorded. If you're comfortable using your full name, please do so. If you want to be Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck, that's okay too. We just ask that we not have too many Mickeys or Donalds in the same meeting. So having said that, at the beginning of this meeting, in just a minute, I'm going to ask people to vote on items that we have on the agenda. And then if there's an item that's not on the agenda, you can also give us some suggestions of other things that you would like Chance and I to discuss. So again, we're willing to discuss things generically. We are not willing to give you legal advice here on the phone in a recorded meeting. However, we will, in fact, accept phone calls and talk to folks offline during the week, please. We need some time off on the weekend. So let's see. As far as other details about the organization, we've been around for 9 years. We were incorporated in 2012, so we're 9 years old. We have annual conferences, which are meant to help educate as well. And when we talk about education, it includes members of this community. So people who run the registry, their family members, their loved ones, and people who support registrants often don't have the same level of information about this worthy cause. And so we're here to share that information with you, and so that we can all, in one respect, use the same vocabulary. So you'll notice with Chance and I, we rarely use the term sex offender because, in fact, nobody is a sex offender. You might have been convicted of a sex offense, but that does not make you a sex offender. So you are an individual. You're required to register, perhaps, and the fact is, or your loved one, and the fact is, the term we prefer to use is registrant. So person who is required to register is a registrant. Maybe you have to register at the YMCA. Maybe you have to register at Target or something like that if you want a discount. But the fact is, I'm comfortable with the term registrant. I'm not comfortable with the term sex offender. Usually, if I use the term sex offender, I'm quoting somebody else using that term, or maybe it's the name of a law. Another term to be careful with, please, is recidivism rate. And I say that because that term recidivism rate is often used against us. And they say, oh, there's a high recidivism rate for people on the registry. Well, it depends how you define that term. Supposedly what people are afraid of is that somebody convicted of a sex offense is going to commit a new sex offense. That's not the recidivism rate. That's the reoffense rate, okay? So that's very different. The reoffense rate, again, is if, in fact, you're convicted of a subsequent or later sex offense, but the recidivism rate is often because somebody has violated the term of parole. And do you want to add to that, Chance?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you're thinking in terms of recidivism, you're thinking in terms of a pattern of criminal conduct, people who commit sexual offenses and then other things. That's recidivism if it's a pattern, including violations of either parole or probation, whereas reoffense rate is directly targeted at sexual offenses. And that's the difference between the two.
Well, thank you for that clarification. So I'm going to go ahead and start asking folks what topic they would like us to discuss. And you're going to need to press 5 and the star key. Is that right, Mike?
Yes.
Okay. So in order to vote on what topic you would like us to discuss, we're going to ask you to press 5 and the star key. Don't press it yet because I haven't mentioned a topic. Because before I do, I want to tell you, for those who have, in fact, listened to other meetings and other recordings, we're going to do something brand new today. Remember, it's a new year, so we can do new things, or at least do old things in new ways. So one of the things we're going to do here is we are going to give to a lucky caller, anybody who has 52 in their phone number, and the first person with the number 52 in their phone number to have called in today is going to get a free autographed copy of my book, which is called Show Up, Stand Up, and Speak Up. So for many of you who know who I am and knew about this organization, you know that's really my mantra. So I'm always encouraging people to show up, stand up, and speak up, and that's the name of my book. There's a picture on the back cover, and that picture includes Mr. Chance Oberstein and myself, and also Frank Lindsay, who's the treasurer of the organization, and we're carrying a banner that says Protect the Constitution. And that picture was taken during a protest we had in the city of Carson, and the city of Carson is in Los Angeles County. So we're not going to announce it now, but Mike is looking at phone numbers. And again, anybody who has 52 in their phone number, it can be the first 3 digits, it can be any of the 10 digits, then in fact he will let me know and we'll announce the winner in about an hour. So let's go ahead and continue, and this is time to vote. The first topic Chance and I are ready, willing, and able to discuss is the proposed SORNA regulations. So if anybody's interested in the SORNA regulations that were issued by the federal government and they were proposed regulations, please press 5 and the star key right now. And again, these were proposed regulations. They were issued by the federal government in August of last year, 2020. And if you're interested in Chance and I discussing this, please press 5 and the star key. And I'm going to give Mike an opportunity here to count votes, and then we'll move on to the next topic. And you can vote more than once, by the way. This is not, you don't just vote once what's your most favorite, but if you'd like Chance and I to discuss a topic, and right now it's the topic of the proposed SORNA regulations, please press 5 and the star key. And Mike, would you, if you would, let us know when you are ready.
26.
26 people want to know about the proposed SORNA regulations. Very good. Let's move on to a bigger topic in many ways, which is the tiered registry here in the state of California. The tiered registry law took effect on January 1st. So we're about 2 weeks into it, and Chance and I, unfortunately, have to report that some problems have already arisen in only the first 2 weeks of the implementation. So if you're interested in hearing more about the tiered registry, if you have a question or a comment, please press 5 and the star key. And while Mike is counting votes, and I'm assuming there's going to be quite a few votes on this one, I want to tell you that if indeed you're not the person who gets a free autographed copy of the book, you can in fact purchase your own copy of the book from Amazon. And it's available on Amazon both electronically through Kindle, or you can purchase a print copy of it. And I have to say, happily, that it only took me about 3 days to get my printed copy of the book. So anyway, there's the book itself is part of the education process of that AXAL is undergoing, and there's a lot of information there for both registrants and people, their family members, and also people who support them. So, Mike, do we have a count yet?
Yes, 33.
33, okay. The next topic is Proposition 57. And so I hope many of you know that we won a state Supreme Court case on this topic. And what Proposition 57 is about is a ballot proposition passed in California that basically said anybody convicted of a nonviolent offense would in fact be considered for early parole. And gosh gee whiz, the Department of Corrections, when they issued their regulations, they created an exception that does not exist in the ballot proposition, and that is they basically tried to exclude anybody convicted of a sex offense ever in their lives, not even just their current custody offense. So if you're interested in Proposition 57, please press 5 and star key. And perhaps there's a lot of people voting.
4 people.
4, you said?
Yes, 4.
Very good. Okay. A topic that usually has a lot of interest is domestic and international travel. So if you are interested in Chance and I discussing domestic and international travel, please press 5 and the star key. Chance and I have been talking about this for a long time, but you know what? It bears repeating the information because sometimes people haven't heard it yet. Other times things have changed, and it's something that is probably of greater interest this year in 2021 as we get vaccinated and we start to be able to travel. And you might just want to know what the rules are if you want to travel within the United States, which is domestic travel, or if you want to travel overseas. So if you're interested in this topic about travel, please press 5 and the star key.
Fourteen
people. Very good. All right, let's move on to COVID. So there are at least 2 COVID issues here. One of them has to do with registration in person, and the other one I would say are people who are incarcerated and the issues that they have related to COVID. So if you're interested in COVID-19 as applied to people on the registry, please press 5 and then the star key.
Eight.
All right, 8 people on that topic. Okay, those are the major topics. The other ones that we plan to address if we have time, one has to do the eligibility of people on the registry to serve as a juror and litigation that we have pending about that. Another one has to do residency restrictions, and the last one, crime-free housing program. So if anybody has a topic that I haven't mentioned, this is the time to speak up. You can speak up later, by the way, if you wish, but it would be helpful now so we know how to allot the time if you press 5 and the star key, and then we'll listen to any question that you might, in fact, have with regard to the issues that you might be facing. And again, folks, Chance and I are not going to be giving you legal advice on the phone. We are lawyers, and we have to be extremely careful not to do that, quite frankly. On the other hand, if you have a generic issue, we can certainly remark about the generics of that, and then we can, in fact, give you personal information on the phone when you're not being recorded. So, again, 5 and the star key if, in fact, you have another issue that I haven't mentioned yet. And do we have any callers right now, Mike?
Yes, we do. Do you want me to call one?
Yes, please.
Okay. I'm going to call on caller 7577. Please go ahead with your call.
Yes, could you please repeat the title of your book, please?
Oh, certainly. Thank you. That's a question. Show Up, Stand Up, and Speak Up. And you can type in the name of it on Amazon, or you can type in my name. Either way, it'll come up. Thank you for that
question.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Next caller, Mark? Yes, I'm going to call on caller last four and the phone number 1129. Caller, please go ahead with your call.
Good morning, Janice and Chance. I hope you all are doing well and staying safe. This is David.
Good morning.
Good morning, David.
Good morning. Janice, if you get a chance, if there's enough time, can you please go over jury service, what's happening, any hearing dates, et cetera?
Sure.
Many thanks.
And do we have any other callers waiting, Mike?
Yes, we do. I see a caller ending in last 45158. Caller, please go ahead. Caller ending in 5158. Please go ahead.
Oh, I accidentally muted, was still muted. Okay, I also wanted to hear about jury service. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. One more. Caller ending in 0656. Please go ahead.
Hi, Janice and Chance. This is Joe in Lompoc. It's not perhaps a topic for... Hi. It's not perhaps a topic for today's discussion, but at some point, could we talk about any action that might be planned for addressing the prohibition against registrants being buried in veteran cemeteries? I have a personal interest in this, of course. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I'll have to bring out a tissue for that one.
There's more callers. I'm going to call in caller last four, 7340. Please go ahead.
Hi, Janice. I had a question. If we bought your book previously, would you be willing to autograph it at a later date?
I would.
Okay.
I think in order to accomplish that, if you sent the book to our address here in Sacramento, and just so everybody has it, the address is 1215, so 1215, K is in Kite Street, and then you have to write comma 17th floor or never get to me, and then that's in Sacramento, and the zip code is 95814, so 95814, and yes, I'd be happy to do that, and just you need to pay the postage to get to us, but you don't have to pay the postage to get it back.
Awesome. Thank you. Love it, by the way. It's a great book. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for that question. Mike?
That's it for now, Janice.
Okay. Very good. Well, thank you all for those questions. When it came to voting, the tiered registry got slightly more votes than proposed SORNA regulations, but I'm going to ignore the vote and go to SORNA regulations first, and I'll tell you why, because we don't have that much to say about the proposed SORNA regulations. Do we, Chance?
No, not much. Not much.
Okay, so so let's take care of that, and then we'll move on to the tiered registry. The bottom line, folks, is this, that the Justice Department, the U.S. Justice Department, proposed federal regulations with regard to SORNA in August of 2020, and then they had public replies that they were accepting through October 13th, and we did, as an organization, we got together with other allies, both other lawyers and other organizations, and we submitted a joint response. Our response was over 35 pages long, and personally, it reads like a law review article. We took it very seriously, and we basically challenged a lot of the proposed regulations. And so having said that, we've heard absolutely nothing since we submitted our proposed regulations. And again, that was on October 13th. So I think no news is good news, frankly. I'm hoping that this administration is way too busy to pay attention to these proposed regulations, but there's no guarantee of that. And I'm certainly hoping even more that the next administration thinks so little of these proposed regulations that they basically ignore them. So if they are ignored and they are not finalized, then in fact, they don't exist in law. And so that is certainly my hope and my prayer, again, that these regulations are not finalized. Would you like to add something to that, Chance?
No, I think that's pretty comprehensive. You know, it was a matter of timing, and it was a matter of the call of the question, which is, you know, any comments and an overabundance of activity aside from the layers of stuff we've witnessed over the past, you know, a few months, culminating in what happened last week. So, you know, it really is questionable as to whether we're going to hear about them again or not. So that's where we're at right now.
Yeah, thank you, Chance. If the Trump administration, which is the current administration, were to finalize the regulations, Congress would have a chance when they convene later this month, or reconvene, to, in fact, basically get rid of the final regulations. But that's not a guarantee either. So I'm certain, from my perspective, it's much better if they never get finalized, the proposed regulations, and then we have nothing to challenge. So, again, that's about all we have to say about the proposed SORNA regulations. But why don't we go ahead and open up the for discussion right now. If anybody has a question or anybody has a comment to make about these proposed SORNA regulations, please press 5 and the star key. So 5 and the star key with regard to these proposed SORNA regulations, if you have a specific question or if you have a specific comment about them. We'll wait here for just a few seconds while Mike sees if there's any callers. If not, the next topic we're going to go to is the tiered registry, and Chance and I have a lot to say about that.
I imagine
many of the callers do too. Okay, very good. Please bring them forward.
Okay. I'm going to call on caller 9982. Please go ahead with your call.
Well, hello, Notorious JMB and Chance. It's Marty. How you guys doing?
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, Marty.
Oh, super fantastic. Thank you. Okay, my question is, if these proposed regulations are ignored for a certain amount of time, is there an automatic expiration date in which they just go away, or they just, you know, continue to collect dust into the eons?
Marty, that is an interesting question, and I don't know the answer to it, but I'm happy to look it up and put it on the website. Do you happen to know the answer, Chance?
No, I don't. I think someone's got to take a look and act or do something about them because they're there. But, you know, it would be better to get a real foundational idea of what actually happens in the process and put it out there.
Yeah, I'm not sure, Marty, and as I said, it's an excellent question. So I will, in fact, look it up, and we'll put it something on the website next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next caller, ending in 3175. Please go ahead.
Hey, how's it going, Chance and Janice? This is Leo.
Good. How you doing, Leo?
Not bad. I had a quick question. So I'm on supervised release currently, and I basically was forced to sign and agree to some regulations as far as the SORNA modifications. From what I understand is we have to check in with the country's embassy prior to leaving the country. Can you guys give us a little information about that?
Well, Janice, you want to take a shot or shall I take a shot?
No, please go ahead, Chance.
Yeah, you're again, just let me understand, you're on parole or probation?
Probation, supervised release, federal.
Yeah, that's a different animal. But remember one thing. When you're on parole or you're on probation, you're subject to reasonable requests made through those two entities. They got to reasonably relate, you know, to your, you know, parole or probationary status. And you got to abide by them until you get off. If they're unreasonable, there is a chain which you could start. You can just start the initial chain of review in deciding whether or not that restriction is reasonable or not through a certain protocol. That, I would say, is better discussed in person. But, you know, it's interesting, and it's an interesting question you bring up because, one, you're under federal supervision, and I take it you're in California. You're not in California?
I am in California. I'm in the Los Angeles, actually Ventura County area.
That's why it's interesting to me, is because, you know, we're not a SORNA state. Although, you know, federal regulation, you know, is really SORNA based. I think it's better individually assessed. You should call either Janice or myself and discuss this more in depth.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, I'm going to take another. Yeah, I'll take another caller. 2841. Please go ahead.
My question was answered. Thank you.
We like those kind of questions.
It was quick.
You're welcome.
I see one more.
Okay.
Caller in 7340.
Hi, good morning. I just had a couple questions that are intertwined. Who, if SORNA is passed, who decides whether California will implement SORNA? Can the DOJ, or is it going to be the governor? Because look how long it took for these tiers to be taken and gotten resolved. Now it would all be re-sorted out again.
Well, you brought up a really good question, and the answer is the state governments implement SORNA, not the federal government, and so that's one of the huge issues that we brought up, which is that if you, the federal government, are going to add all these new requirements, and oh, by the way, you don't plan to pay the states to implement it. What is the registrant supposed to do, right? So, for example, if somebody becomes a Tier 3 registrant under SORNA, you have to register four times a year. And yeah. California state government at this point only registers people once a year, unless you're a transient or a couple of other exceptions. But that's a really good question. So that's one of the things the legal arguments that we made was, you know, the federal government cannot be telling the states how to implement its sex offender laws.
But the governor would have to, yeah, the DOJ can't just say, yeah, we want SORNA in California. California DOJ can, yeah, we want it.
You know what? I mean, they could. I don't think that they actually weighed in on these proposed SORNA regulations. By the way, there were over 800 responses, so I might have missed it. But I didn't. Yeah. I was certainly looking for it to see if California DOJ had responded to it. In the past, the state of California has always resisted SORNA, and the reason or excuse was that if SORNA is implemented in any state, then you have to list juveniles on your Megan's Law website, and that has been either a reason or excuse to keep SORNA out of California, and I don't care if it is a reason or an excuse,
yeah.
But whatever it takes to keep it out of our state.
You know, also,
and California, yeah. Go ahead,
also, the other thing is, and you know, that what Janice is saying is absolutely true, and also, you know, we would be a SORNA state today, but for the cost. It's expensive to implement it if you have a large population of registrants. We are a state that has a large population of registrants, so it would cost us much more to implement that and keep it than it would to keep our own system. And since our own system is more cost beneficial, it's unlikely you'll see it implemented by the state of California. The real issue is whether or not the federal government can bleed in certain requirements to really complicate things for registrants in this state. That's the issue. That's why those regulations really, you know, really were, you know, stark for us. I mean, there are a lot of constitutional issues there, and mm-hmm. one of which is, you know, a state sovereignty to take care of its own within its state. So there was a lot of pushback on that. So I wouldn't worry about it just yet.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Did you have another question or comment? I thought you said you had two.
Oh, I do have another one. Are you talking about me?
No, but go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, she went off. She's gone now. Let's see. Okay, our next caller ended in 1129. Please go ahead.
Good morning again.
I think we already had that caller before.
You did, and now you've got David back again. Hi.
Hey,
hi, David. Always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. You're too kind. Two questions regarding SORNA. First of all, and I think you've addressed this, but maybe you could clarify for me, is there any ticking clock-like deadline when we would know it goes into effect or doesn't go into effect?
Well, Marty asked that question, and my answer was no, about part of it, which is basically, is there a deadline for it to either die or to be passed? This is the good news. It doesn't automatically become final, okay? So the federal government will have to take an affirmative action in order to finalize the regulations. So we would know if they were doing that. And I don't, as I promised Marty, I'm happy to look that up, and we can post the answer on the website so everybody will know whether or not there is a deadline for these proposed regulations. In other words, if they aren't finalized by a certain date, would in fact they basically be erased? That's what I don't know the answer to, but again, I'm willing to research it next week and put that answer on the website.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
And my second question regarding SORNA is, and I know you can't get into great detail as far as legal strategy and stuff like that, but do you have any idea how the Gundy non-delegation Supreme Court ruling might interact with these SORNA proposed regulations? Because I know you had like a 37-page response, I believe it was, to the regulation. So.
Yeah, we did. You know, David, I have to admit, I'm not totally familiar with the Gundy case, so I can't tell you off the top of my head. I know we have another, and by the way, I can say David is on our board of directors. We have a fellow board member who is very familiar with that case, and so I think we relied upon his expertise. Perhaps Chance remembers more about Gundy than I do.
Okay.
Well, my mind's a little blank, too, on that right now. So I'd have to look at my notes and things like that, which I don't have right now. But go ahead, David, remind us if you have.
No problem.
If you remember.
Gundy was, as I understand it, Gundy was specifically about the non-delegation of authority from the legislature to an administrative branch, to the DOJ, in fact. And the Supreme Court ruled that, no, it was okay for the Department of Justice to implement laws, specifically the one that includes ex post facto, reaching back and including all sex offenders. They said, no, that's okay for the government to delegate that authority to one of the departments.
And I have to say, it's not striking any chords in my mind, even though I do civil law and constitutional issues. And I know Gundy is out there, but I don't think it's front and center in how we would oppose the regulations if indeed they were finalized. So I hope that you, David, and everybody else who's listening, whether today or in the future, listening to this recording, understand that if these SORNA regulations are finalized, we will file a lawsuit. I mean, we will. We have to, because many people would be adversely affected, so many people on the registry, not just in California, by the way, but nationwide. At this point in time, there are only 17 states that are SORNA compliant. So 33 states have said thanks but no thanks to SORNA, and so this would cause a whole lot of trouble in a lot of ways. And I'll tell you the primary way I think is it's going to cause uncertainty in people's lives. So you won't know how many times you have to really have to register. For example, that example that I brought up earlier, if you are assigned to Tier 3, for example, that in fact you would have to register 4 times a year. Well, what happens when you go to your registration office and the registration office says, we're not going to register you. We only register people once a year, right? What do you do then? So I think that, you know, to me, that's probably the biggest problem with these proposed regulations is uncertainty. And we experience that here in California, and I know other states are still experiencing it with things like presence restrictions, right? So presence restrictions are basically laws that are telling people on the registry that they can't visit certain places. And guess what? That there aren't any signs warning people about what, you know, at those places. Like, literally in California, some of the towns passed an ordinance that said, if you're on the registry, you can't walk on the pier, right? You can't walk in the pier in certain cities. But there was no sign to tell you that. So the fact is, a lot of people just stayed home because they were afraid to travel anywhere because they didn't know what, you know, if there were presence restrictions and if there were, what they were. Other ones, by the way, that said you couldn't go to the dog park. So, we need to avoid that uncertainty.
David, I mean, yeah, to your point, in your mention of Gandhi, the DOJ, you know, the Congress can delegate to them so that they can delegate the promulgating new rules and regulations. That's what we're dealing with. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're acceptable or that they're constitutional or that they stick. So those things still can be challenged. And a lot of the bases, the foundations for these particular regulations, I think, I'm just going to say it straight out, I think they're unconstitutional. And so that is what promulgated us to you know, get involved and to put out this lengthy challenge to what those regulations were saying. We put it out there because we realized that the foundations were very, very, to us at least, they were at base unconstitutional. And, you know, just because you have the authority to promulgate rules doesn't necessarily mean that those are set in stone. And so, you know, it's just like the state of California delegates to the Department of Corrections to do things. Doesn't mean they can't be challenged.
Right. As Janice knows very well and keeps winning.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, thank
Happy
you.
Happy to be of service.
Yep.
All right. So at this point in time, Mike, do we have any more callers?
Yes, we do.
Waiting for SORNA regulations. Please go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to call on caller ending in 2433. Please go ahead.
Good morning and Happy New Year to all of you. Got a question on SORNA and dual track. Is it possible that the feds plug in requirements that would apply? And
caller, unfortunately, you're breaking up. I can't really hear you. Can you speak up? And maybe if you're on speakerphone, take off the speakerphone.
Okay, I'm off speakerphone. Is this better?
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm wondering about dual tracking, federal regulations and laws that we can get nicked with if we travel overseas and out of country. And even though California may not apply SORNA, we wouldn't have to comply with their requirements. If the feds say we have requirements, can we get nicked for that because we didn't comply with the federal regulations even though we live in California?
Do you want to answer that, Chance, first?
Yeah, I think the answer is probably yes. And that's the problem. It's kind of like, you know, IML and SORNA requirements. You know, you don't want to end up being, if you're a Californian and, you know, you don't comply with those requirements, like 21 days notice and everything, you don't want to be the first test case that when you come back into secondary and, you know, get put in, you know, get held up and held in custody, you don't want to be the first test case. So, you know, that means that it's probably good insurance to do the 21-day notice requirement. Yes, I think there's an indication by the court, and I'm talking about the Supreme Court, that, you know, federal regulations pertaining to the registry in general, those should be, you know, that the loophole there, that some states are not SORNA, has been sewn up. Now, I would steer you to a case called Nichols, and I'll let Janice, you know, speak a little bit more on that. But that's my position. I think you got to take these things seriously. Janice?
Sure. I concur. I agree with Chance wholeheartedly. And folks, what we're worried about is the federal government basically adding on requirements that are not state requirements. And one of them is already in existence, and it has to do with overseas travel. So right now, the International Megan's Law, which is also part of the proposed SORNA regulations here, requires people to notify local law enforcement at least 21 days before they travel overseas. You know, and it's like, well, is a California registrant or any other registrant in a non-SORNA state, remember there are a total of 33 non-SORNA states, required, you know, to give 21-day notice. And Chance and I have, as attorneys, we have the same opinion, which is it's better to do that than not to do it. Because what if the federal government basically presses charges against you and tries to convict you for failing to comply with that requirement. And Chance brought up a U.S. Supreme Court called Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S, and in the Nichols case, Mr. Nichols left Kansas, the state of Kansas, and moved to the Philippines without giving the state of Kansas any notice that he was moving. He just, you know, got on a flight one night and he moved to the Philippines. And our federal government basically chased him over to the Philippines and had him extradited to the U.S., charged him with a crime, which was failing to notify the state of Kansas, and which was a federal requirement, but which was not a state requirement. And quite frankly, at that point, and Mr. Nichols, he won. He ultimately won his case. But what happened to that poor man before he won his case, right? How much grief did he go through? He was dragged back from the Philippines to the United States involuntarily. I'm sure he was in custody at least part of the time as his case made it all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's why Chance and I recommend that people go ahead and give the 21-day notice, even if perhaps that federal law does not apply to individuals in a non-SORNA state like California and 32 other states. So please, folks, you know, Chance and I give you information like this, and you're the one that makes the ultimate decision. You can ignore my recommendation, Chance's recommendation, but if, in fact, you make the wrong decision, you're the one who's going to go to federal prison, and I'm not going to federal prison, and Chance isn't going to federal prison, for at least that advice. So I think it's time that we move on now to our tiered registry questions. We've been talking about SORNA much longer than I thought we would. I thought that was going to be it. Oh, yes,
Janice,
please.
You're still there?
I am. Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I had one other portion of that question. Since the challenges will be coming up after SORNA is implemented, has anyone thought about addressing the aspect of we're really telling other countries what they must do for people register to move into their country or to visit their country? I would think they would want to get the tourist income from us and not be encumbered by the federal regulations. So has anyone taken that approach?
Well, we've sued the federal government twice now because of the International Megan's Law, and that's what triggers the notice to other countries, and we lost. So I'm still looking for the perfect plaintiff in that case. I call it my Rosa Parks plaintiff. I thought I had a few in the first case, seven plaintiffs in a wide range of circumstances, including men who had wives overseas and were caught in a situation where they could not visit that country and their wives could not come to this country. So, we had a federal judge who thought that was not constitute harm, and therefore we didn't have standing. It wasn't ripe. the case wasn't ripe. So so anyway, I don't think we're going to be able to stop the notifications, I guess, is the bottom line. What do you think about that, Chance?
Well, yeah, no, but, you know, and also, you know, when you're talking to other countries, you know, the United States is not alone, you know, it isn't in its own ecosystem alone. It is tied all over the world to all different countries. I mean, God knows how many countries it has relations with, exchanges money with, supports. And so, you know, if you know, the United States wants a certain policy to be adhered to, it's called, you know, the purse string approach determines how that country, that receiving country, acts. And so you find in this in this world of restraints and constraints and all kinds of things, a list of countries, 20, I think it's 26 of them called the Schengen countries, who don't necessarily deal with the United States in that way. And even if they do, have declared that these are open zones for travel no matter what. I can't say that for the rest of the world. Things change, dynamics change. But, you know, the countries aren't independent and on their own making decisions about this other than those Schengen countries.
Yeah, thank you for that additional information, Chance. So, and I want to repeat that there are 26 nations in Europe that do not care if you're on the registry. The four large nations of the 26 are Italy, France, Germany, and Spain. So I'm proud. I'm a proud Italian, of Italian heritage anyway, and that Italy has a clear mind about this and will welcome you if you decide to go visit there. However, need to say that if you're trying to visit Asia, your options are limited to Hong Kong, and Hong Kong right now has great political unrest. Might not be the best time to visit Hong Kong, but the fact is most of Asia is off limits. And by the way, to people convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, anybody under the age of 18, and who is required to register. So there is additional information about countries to which registrants have attempted to travel, and that is on the website of an organization called the Registrant Travel Action Group, and they're available at www.rttag.org. So rttag.org, and they have a matrix there that reflects people's experiences trying to visit other countries. Please, folks, go look at that their matrix, because literally, a registrant that I know quite well contacted me between Christmas and New Year's in tears, and he had tried to travel to Brazil and was not able to get into Brazil, even though he had a loved one waiting for him and other people. If you do travel to a country that does not allow you to enter, you will not get out of the airport. And people don't seem to understand that. It's not like you're going to see your loved one, get the hug, fist bump, or whatever we're doing these days. You will not be able to get out of the airport. You will not see your loved one. You may or may not actually even be able to make a call to that person. So you'll waste a lot of time, and you'll waste a lot of money, and you will not get that money back from the government or anybody else. So please be careful about your overseas travel. So, folks, I'm sorry. We need to move on here. We really need to talk about the tiered registry. Right before we do that, though, I want to announce that we have a winner of this first autographed copy of the book, and it's somebody whose telephone number includes the two-digit number 52. So Mike, who is running the switchboard, he knows who you are. And Mike, I'm not sure the best way that person can get in contact with you. Can they do that directly, or should I just have them contact me through the organization's phone number?
Probably a good idea to have them contact you, because you're going to be in charge of the book. I will give you, I better give some information here. Maybe, okay. Let me call on them so that they can make sure they have everything they need to know. This is a caller that his number.
Just the last four digits, Mike.
Yeah. Right, exactly. The number ends in 2252. Caller, if you're there, please identify yourself so that you can get a hold of Janet.
So we'll wait for that person to call 5 and the star key while we introduce the topic of the tiered registry. 5 and the star key caller. And then there is another phone number that I would like to announce to everybody, and that is the phone number for the RSOL switchboard, I like to call it. And anyway, you'll probably end up talking to me. But the phone number is area code 818, then 305-5984. So 818-305-5984. If you want a private consultation with either me or with Chance, call that number first, and then we can get you started from there. But again, 818-305-5984. So, Mike, do we have the person whose phone number is, 2252 on the line?
Caller, your last 4 is 2252. Could you say hi, let us know that you're there?
And caller, if you're no longer there or if you're bashful, you don't have to do 5 and the star key. You can call that number that I just gave, 818-305-5984. And Mike, if you'd be kind enough to send me the full phone number, I'll follow up if I don't hear from them, okay?
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, and folks, the way we did this is I chose a 2-digit number before the meeting started, and I had Mike looking out for it, and the first person who had 52 in their phone number is the lucky winner, and will receive an autographed copy, a free autographed copy of the book. Okay, so let's move on to the tiered registry, because this is a big topic, and the timing is such that it only took effect on January 1st. I mean, today is the 16th, and the 1st was a holiday. So really, the California Department of Justice had 2 weeks to implement it so far. And so far, they have made 2 big mistakes that we're aware of. There may be other mistakes out there. And before Chance and I start discussing their mistakes, I want to say that I've also seen a few letters that have said somebody's assigned appropriately to Tier 1 or Tier 2. The problem is we've seen other people who've been inappropriately assigned to Tier 3 already, and again, it's only in the first 2 weeks. In addition to that, I know that many people on our website were complaining about the City of Long Beach and how the City of Long Beach was not providing anybody providing tier assignment information at all. And so I tracked down the registration officer there, spoke to her, and I also spoke to the California Department of Justice, because the registration officer in Long Beach said, oh, we haven't been trained yet on this. And that was troubling to hear, because you know what, folks, the Department of Justice has had more than 3 years to implement this. Think about it. This law was passed in October of 2017, and now we're January of 2020, so it's been 3 years plus a few months that DOJ has had to implement this. I know that they've hired more than 60 new people to be working on this, and yet people are being told, registrants are being told when they contact their local law enforcement office, oh gosh, gee whiz, we don't have a tier assignment letter for you. And for those who live in Long Beach and are listening to this, please know that this problem is now being addressed both by the City of Long Beach and the Department of Justice. And I was told in an email by the Department of Justice that Long Beach had misunderstood something about what they can and can't do. And so anyway, hopefully Long Beach will have a different story next week. Chance, do you want to go on to the early implementation here of the tiered registry?
Well, you know, just to get things started, you know, it's first of all, you know, this is the first part of the process. So, you know, just to start off, you know, you're asking for tier assignment. Okay. Second part is eligibility, and third part is whether you're going to be opposed, non-opposed, or hearing. So this is the first stage. A lot of people are expecting classifications based on their misdemeanor status or whatnot. and are being surprised that they're being put up in Tier 3 when they should be probably in Tier 1. There's going to be a lot of these mismatches. There's going to be a lot of things happening. There's going to be a lot of reassessment because this is not a perfect process, nor are the attorneys who work for the Department of Justice trained to really recognize everything. There's going to be a lot of to be determined because a lot of records are in the archives, old, lost, non-existent. So this is going to be a chaotic mess. And I'm going to remind everybody that, you know, we've faced these things before. I mean, we actually had to sue the Department of Justice because they had 5 years to put dates of convictions on records pertaining to registrants that they were posting, and they hadn't done that. And so, you know, it looked like people were being, you know, who were convicted yesterday and causing great fear in the community and threat upon those who were registering and who were posted. So, you know, we're not unfamiliar with these types of issues, and this is a huge, chaotic, crazy mess. So that's where I want to start with this. Janice?
There's some very lofty legal terms you use there, a big chaotic mess. And I totally agree with you, Chance. And folks, again, it's only been 2 weeks since the tiered registry law took effect. And again, this agency had 3 years to prepare for this week, or these 2 weeks. So having said that, these are the two overarching problems that we've noted. One is that people who were convicted of a wobbler felony, and not all felonies are wobblers. Let's just make sure everybody understands that. But there are some felonies that are considered wobblers. And what that means in California is that you're convicted of a felony, but that felony, it's possible to reduce that felony to a misdemeanor. That's a huge difference, right? So a felony to a misdemeanor. The two categories that I know that probably have the greatest number of people are Penal Code Section 288 parentheses C. So again, Penal Code Section 288 parentheses C, and also sexual battery, which is 243.4. So, and not, by the way, not all subsections of 243.4 sexual battery are wobblers either. But for the ones that are, we have individuals who have gone to the trouble and expense of getting their wobbler felonies reduced to a misdemeanor. And when you do that, folks, this is what it says, that you are now a misdemeanant for all purposes. That's it. That's what the law says. And so here, so Chance and I have been talking for quite some time and saying our expectation was, though we always qualified and said, who knows what the California Department of Justice is going to do about this, and it's a good thing we did put that caveat, because now the California Department of Justice early on is basically saying that people who have had their felonies reduced to a misdemeanor, they're putting them, assigning them to Tier 3, the highest tier, which makes no sense because for all purposes of the law, remember that phrase, for all purposes, you are a misdemeanant, and as a misdemeanant, you should be on Tier 1, not Tier 3. And maybe, Chance, you want to add to that?
Well, you know, what these are general terms they're using, and then they're digging through and making determinations based not just on conviction, but other things. But let's just say once, you know, for a person who's just been convicted of one misdemeanor their entire life, I mean, it's pretty hard to justify that you're going to be, you know, a Tier 3 person, especially, you know, let's just take a sexual battery, which could be a minor touching if it's a misdemeanor. So, you know, for a minor touching to be up in Tier 3 is pretty crazy.
And I certainly would agree with that. So because of that, we brought this issue to our board of directors in our monthly meeting this past week. And the board has, in fact, given us a green light to file a lawsuit challenging this implementation, faulty implementation by California Department of Justice of the tiered registry law. So there's no ambiguity to it. California DOJ is doing this. I don't know of anybody that's been properly assigned to Tier 1. If you're one of those people, you can please call the number 818-305-5984. Again, 818-305-5984, and talk to me And I'm going to congratulate you that you're one of the few, or maybe the only person, maybe you are the unicorn, that got the right tier designation from California Department of Justice. But so far, everybody that Chance and I have heard from who had a wobbler reduced to a misdemeanor have received a tier assignment letter that says you're on tier three. And that's not what the law says, and therefore we're going to challenge that implementation. The second major mistake that DOJ appears to have already made is this, that people who are getting letters that say, we don't know what tier you're in, your tier is to be determined. That's what I'm looking at a letter right now that says that. It says the DOJ has designated you as tier to be determined. Okay. The tiered registry law allows that to happen. However, and the letter says that it's going to take them up to 24 months, that's 2 years, right, to determine what your proper designation is. And that, is in the law. But the following comment is not in the law. This is what it says. You may not petition for termination of your sex offender registration requirement until the DOJ has designated your tier level. That authority is not in the sex offender, the tiered registry law. It's not. And so they have created for themselves authority from somewhere. It's kind of like, you know, CDCR basically rewriting Proposition 57. Here, the California Department of Justice is rewriting the tiered registry law, basically telling people that you cannot petition to get off the registry until they've designated your tier level. And, oh, by the way, that's going to take them up to an additional 2 years. And to that I call nonsense. Okay? No, that's not what the law says. They do not have the authority to make you wait until they have designated your tier level. Now, might it make it harder to get your petition approved? Perhaps. But the fact is that they don't have the authority to do this. So what we did as an organization is we wrote to the California DOJ a three-page letter basically saying, telling them what I've just said to you, which is you don't have the authority to tell people that they have to wait. And then asking DOJ to basically reverse themselves on this and to remove that sentence from everybody's tier designation letter. So in other words, DOJ has the right to determine, to decide somebody is in a to-be-determined tier, but they don't have the right to prevent you from petitioning. And Mr. Frank Lindsay, who many of you know, good old Frank Lindsay, who was our treasurer and also one of the founders of this organization, I'm looking at his letter right now. This man was convicted more than 40 years ago, 40 years ago. He's been convicted of one offense in his entire life and none since he was convicted of this offense. And it just scrambles my brain to try to understand why DOJ thinks that, you know, they can't figure out his tier level. They've had 3 years, more than 3 years to figure it out. But they think that they're telling him they can't figure out his tier designation. And oh, by the way, they're telling him he has to wait 2 more years before he can petition. And I think, again, that's utter nonsense. Anna, do you want to address that topic, Chance?
Well, I agree with you. It's just nonsense. They've had more than enough time. And they need to be more specific as to why. This is not acceptable, just absolutely unacceptable.
So folks, if you have a question or a comment about the tiered registry law and the process here, this is the time to press 5 and the star key. Again, 5 and the star key. And just to say, these tier assignment letters are a critical part of the petitioning process and reminding everybody that the beginning date for petitions is July 1. So January 1, the law came into effect, and cure assignment letters were supposed to be available for everyone starting January 1st of this year. And by the way, they're in a government-only database, so no private attorney, including Chance and I, we do not have access to that database, but the government does. And they should be able to pull out the information out of their database to tell you what tier you have been assigned to. And then we've got the petitioning process that starts on July 1. Please understand that the state legislature passed a law in the second part of 2020, adding what I call the birthday rule. So basically you have to wait. The earliest you can petition is the month of your birthday on starting July of 2021. So, yes, indeed, people who were born January, February, March, April, May, and June of the year, in a year, you may not petition this year. You'll have to wait until 2022. But the fact is, if you were born in July, August, September, October, November, or December of the year, no matter what the year was, and you're otherwise eligible, you can petition for removal starting this year in 2021. And I'm happy to say I have a client whose birthday's in July, about the 10th of July, and I can't wait to file the first petition. So having said that, how are we doing on calls there, Mike?
Yes, we have some callers. I'm a big caller. Caller ending in 0633. Please go ahead.
Hi, folks. I hope you enjoyed your holidays and appreciate the time. Just had a quick question. My offense occurred in California. I'm no longer on parole or probation. I'm here in Nevada, however. How do I go about finding out what my tier is in California?
That's easy to answer. You won't have a tier. You don't have a tier because you're not required to register in California.
Gotcha.
The tiered registry law does not apply to you.
Okay, but I want to actually get removed from the registry. Do I have to do it then in Nevada, or can I still? It sounds like I could do it in California. When I spoke to
Chance, do you
want to
answer that question?
Well, here's the problem. You know, in order to be removed from California, you got to be in California. When you process out of California, you're no longer on the registry. The first draft of this tiered system considered out-of-state registrants in being removed from the registry. This particular draft does not. Draft that's been now made into law. Therefore, in order to apply, you have to be within the state of California. So you have to establish residency within the state of California. That's
I got
it. And if your conviction happened, it originated in California, then, you know, now's the time to establish residency here and get that determination after that.
I got you. All right. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're certainly welcome.
Next caller. Caller ended in 3175. Please go ahead.
Hello, hello.
Caller ended in 3175.
Well, Mike, either they put themselves on mute or they've hung up, so let's please go to the next one.
Okay. Next caller. Caller ending in 5268. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Rich. And I wanted to thank both you, Janice, and Chance for all the hard work you're doing on this. I was curious, when am I allowed to find out what my letter is designation? Do I have to wait for my birthday? It's in February, but I was just curious if I'm going to get, you know, yelled at if I show up too early to find out what my designation letter is.
No, you don't have to wait. You can ask them now. And people have gotten a wide variety of responses. So some people have called the registration office. Oh, by the way, remember, we're in the middle of a pandemic. So some offices are not even open. But if you have a phone number for your registration officer, you can call the registration officer. And registration officers sometimes have told people on the phone what their tier level is. Some people have even emailed them the letters. And other people, other registration officers have sent them in the mail. So there's a variety of ways that your registration might cooperate with you. And again, they might not. But you do not have to wait.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Next caller. Caller in 5158. Please go ahead.
I was left over from the previous one, but mine went fine. They had the letter ready and it was appropriate. And that's it. Thanks.
Great. Congratulations.
Well, one question. Never mind. I think we lost that caller, but I was gonna
go ahead, Chance.
Okay, what conviction are we speaking about? What was the conviction
288A. It was listed as tier two, as I expected.
Okay. All I got to say is excellent. That's what I got to say. Excellent.
A caller ending in 8894. Please go ahead.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Axel, for following up, and Janice for following up with Long Beach. My husband registers in both Orange County and Long Beach, so while Long Beach is getting worked over, is there any news from Orange County? When I called on January 6th, they stated that we would have to wait till their annual registration time, which ours is in October, to get the letter. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, so would you like to comment on that?
No, go ahead. I think you've got it.
Well, the answer is that's nonsense. I'm trying not to swear today, people. This is recorded. But anyway, it's at least nonsense. There's no reason that somebody has to wait until the month of their birthday. That's not what the law says. That's, you know, local registration office being difficult. But since your husband is also registered in Long Beach, I recommend he wait until next week in Long Beach. I think Long Beach is going to have a big thaw next week after they have their consultation here with the Department of Justice. And if that doesn't happen, please contact me on that number, 818-305-5984. Again, 818-305-5984.
Thank you so much.
You're certainly welcome.
Next caller. Caller ending in 2287.
Hey, y'all. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Carrie. Good morning to y'all. First of all, I want to say thank you for suing the DOJ. They've basically been... they've been begging us to sue them, and they're almost incentivizing, taking away our constitutional rights. It's almost like they're incentivized by it. So stick it to them, and let us know if you need anything else to bring it forward. I have just a comment I want to share.
Thank you.
But my question is this. It's a more broader question. Back in 2006, I believe, they formed a board, an advisory board for policy in California. And most recently, in 2015, 2016, and 2017, this board has had some sensible studies and some sensible thoughts about the registry, and the legislature just completely ignores it. What is the purpose of that board? I mean, Schwarzenegger brought it forth.
So I think, caller, you're referring to the California Sex Offender Management Board. Axel is very aware of the board. We go to its meetings. Chance and I have made presentations to the board. And it is frustrating sometimes because the board has, in fact, come up with I think you used the term sensible, and if you did, I agree with that. But straightforward, you know, factually correct reports. And in fact, they were allies in our effort to get a tiered registry passed. But in the past, the Sex Offender Management Board has done a really bad job of actually communicating with the state legislature. So the state legislature created the Sex Offender Management Board, and supposedly the board is to make recommendations to the legislature. But when we first found out about them, what we found out was that the board would basically send copies of their reports in the mail to the legislative offices. I'm a former staffer myself, a congressional staffer, and I remember what happened when people mailed me reports. I would open up the envelope and go, well, that looks interesting, and I'd put it on a large stack of reports, right, and hope that someday I would get the chance to read them. But I didn't often actually read them all because I would just keep getting, you know, new reports every day. So what we have done actually as an organization is we have taken reports issued by the Sex Offender Management Board to the legislature and say, remember that body that you created? Well, here's what they have to say on that topic. And so we have, in fact, seen more people in the legislature pay attention to the board. And by the way, some of the board members, and the members are all representatives from state agencies, they have come and testified before the state legislature, and of course that gives them a higher profile as well. But in the beginning, and Frank Lindsay and I, one of our first meetings in Sacramento was with the executive director of the Sex Offender Management Board, and he expressed his frustration to us that in fact they were not being listened to by the legislature. I think they're getting more attention from the legislature now, but you know, it's not 100% yet, and I think you've made a really good point, so thanks for bringing it up. Chance, do you want to add anything?
It's persuasive.
The only thing I would add to that is when we first approached the management board, we were not appreciated too much. The last time we did, they showed great appreciation and listened intently, and so we've gone from being a really non-voice to a very strong voice, and so and we think that has made some positive steps in terms of our credibility and our advisory role. I think it will help in the future to make recommendations to that entity, which now I think is being recognized a credible source of information to the legislature now. It wasn't before, but now I think it is. I mean, let's face it, they were very, very involved in implementing the tiered system. And, you know, I think that as time goes by, they're gaining respect rather than being ignored. They were initially ignored. I think they're getting more respect now.
And I want to add to what Chance just said, because this last presentation, and Chance and I made it together to the board, we got a standing ovation. So the people who were there, who, by the way, in the beginning when we would give reports, whether it was Chance or me or other board members, some combination thereof, they would basically yawn and we wouldn't even get any questions. And this time, folks, you know, they applauded for us. I practically fell over, though I was standing up. I can't say I was falling out of my chair, but I was quite surprised by the fact that we got applause, and actually not once but twice. So, and in that presentation, you all need to know, we reached out to the Sex Offender Management Board and we asked them to join us in fixing the tiered registry. Okay, we said these are the ways we want to fix it, and it included creating an off-ramp for everybody on Tier 3. So if you're on Tier 3, this hasn't passed yet, but this is our proposal, that registrants assigned to Tier 3 would, in fact, be able to petition for removal. It would not be automatic, but petition for removal after 30 years. That's a really long time. We understand that. But when the other tiers are 10 and 20 years, we don't think we can say 21 years, right? We think that needs to start with 30, but at least it would create an off-ramp that might give us room to reduce the terms of registration at a later time, but at least create an off-ramp there. Another one, of course, is to get all the people convicted of any type of offense involving an and unlawful image, otherwise known as, quote, child pornography. So right now, unfortunately, you know, if you look at a picture and somebody's 17 years old, that's considered child pornography. So anyway, we want to get the CP offenses off of Tier 3 because right now all felony CP offenses are on Tier 3. Okay, so this was a proposal that Chance and I made to the Sex Offender Management Board, and they applauded. Now, have they helped us quite yet? No, not yet. But we're hoping here in the year 2021, if we can figure out how to safely lobby in the state capitol. And by the way, our state capitol here in Sacramento, like many state capitals, there's huge fences around them. Now, they're not allowing anybody in the building. So it's not going to happen when we normally lobby, which is in February. I think we're going to be delayed. But we will keep up the drumbeat and make sure that the tiered registry law gets changed in a way that benefits people on the registry.
And Janice, I think it's important also for you to mention who composes this board. Who's on it? Because, you know, I mean, every agency, every criminal justice agency in the state of California is represented, but Janice, you could probably do that better than me.
Well, I could pull up the roster here, but there are about 20, and there's people coming and going, so between usually 20 and 25 people on this board, and certainly the Department of Justice is represented, CDCR is represented, by the way, parole's represented, probation's represented. I mean, it's really weighted heavily in favor of law enforcement, and then we have one person, only one, who represents criminal defense attorneys. So, by the way, also victims advocates. There's two victims advocates organizations on there as well. So the constitution of the board depends upon legislation. Nowhere does it say people who represent registrants have a voice or a chair at the table. I hope someday that will change. It's not our highest priority, quite frankly, but because we still go to their meetings, we still say things, we still criticize them or pat them on the back when we think they've done a good job. And we certainly are educating the legislature about the board, who the heck they are, and why they should be listened to.
And also, I think it's persuasive in court, too.
Yeah, just to emphasize this. Yeah. It is persuasive in court, and one of the representatives that sits on that board represents all the judges in the state of California. So, you know, this is an important body.
All right, thank you all.
You're welcome. Thank you as well.
Keep up the great.
So we promise we'll keep it up.
Thank you.
Mike, I'm assuming we have another caller or two.
Yes, we do. I'll take caller ending in the last four numbers, 7063. Please go ahead. 7063.
Oh, hi. I think that's me.
Hello.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, hi. Good morning to everyone.
How can we help you, sir?
In my case, it was involving a military court in 1996. And, by the way, thank you, Janice, and your team for doing a great job.
You're welcome.
On January 12th, I called Chula Vista PD, and I was asking for my classification letter, and I was told that it's not determined yet.
And let me stop you there, sir. I think is to be expected. So there's three categories of convictions that, to me, warrant more time. People convicted like you in military court, people convicted in federal court, maybe, and then also people convicted out of state. So California Department of Justice has stated, even in a document that they issued earlier this year, but they issued a similar document last year, that people in those three categories were going to be placed in the to-be-determined category. And so for that, I think it might be appropriate, even though, as you said, you were convicted a long time ago in 1996.
My legal counsel back then told me that in my case it was equivalent to a misdemeanor.
Well, I hope they agree with you. If they don't, please call.
Okay.
And we'll try to get their attention. But, I mean, it can be difficult. You're certainly welcome. If you have a military court conviction, if you have an out-of-state conviction, even sometimes with a federal conviction, it can be somewhat difficult. Though I will tell you, it makes no sense to me with a CP conviction, like, again, for unlawful images by the federal government. To me, that seems like it would be very easy to figure out what the California equivalent is. Do you have anything you want to add to that, Chance?
No, other than, you know, I mean, you know, at face value, most things outside of the state, and I'm talking about the federal government, anything, you know, involved federally really involves felonies, whether, you know, and I'm not sure that there are any equivalents. You know, if it's federal, it's typically a felony. There's no federal misdemeanors. Okay, so, and stuff that's equivalent to a misdemeanor may be, I mean, in terms of what it is, the character of what it is, but it's still classified as a felony because, as far as I'm aware, there's no federal misdemeanors.
Okay, thank you.
I agree. You're welcome. Mike, next call, please.
Yes. Our next caller, phone number ends in 7148. 7148.
Good morning, Janice and Chance.
Good morning.
How is everyone doing?
Good.
This is Mr. D, and I've got a kind of multi-part, but I think three of these things really apply to probably a lot of folks. One would be some questions I saw a lot on the website this past week on what qualifies as an exclusion going forward. And if I read it correctly, it's mostly related to if the victim was related to you, essentially.
Are you talking about an exclusion from the Megan Saul website?
Yeah, for starting next year in January.
Okay. Well, I'll stop there because let's give everybody some background information. The one part of the tiered registry law basically says that fewer people are going to be excluded from the Megan Saul website. So prior to the tiered registry law, there were several categories of people who basically their information was not posted on the public website called Megan's Law. And this tiered registry law is going to change that. So with that kind of background, please continue.
Yeah, so it looks like they were eliminating a lot of the convictions or so forth that would be eligible before and was basically down to if you were related to the victim. Is that how you or Chance see that as well based on the new law?
I'm not willing to agree or disagree with that statement. I don't have the law in front of me. I just know more people are going to be added to the Megan Saul website, and I'm willing to agree to that. How about you, Chance?
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't, you know, I'm not sure how this is all going to work out, but most of the exclusions are going to be eliminated. That's my understanding.
Right.
Okay. And the second part of this, which is kind of a two-part question, Tier 3, if you've been elevated to Tier 3, until that's fixed or if it's fixed, you now have to register 4 times a year?
No.
Even if you had a misdemeanor?
No.
Oh,
no.
Still once a year? Okay.
No.
Thank goodness.
I think what you're mixing up there is a part of the proposed SORNA regulation. And so if somebody's on Tier 3 of federal SORNA, they do have to register 4 times a year. We don't have federal SORNA in our state. Our state only requires once a year unless you move, unless you're, you know, homeless and some other exceptions. But the general rule in California is once a year.
Okay, good. And then the last part was, do you see a 1203.4 having any positive effect on the tier assignment? Or is that to be determined as well?
Chance, do you want to answer that?
Yeah, I'd love to. Anything you can do to mitigate is important. If you can get a 1203.4, that says that you completed your probation without violation, and that's a mitigating circumstance. And the less, you know, when it comes down to risk assessment, every single positive thing you can do is important, including 1203.4, because you're less of a risk if you participated in probation, did what you were supposed to do, and completed it successfully.
And I want to add something to that. That I do not believe a 1203.4 is going to give you a different tier assignment because tier assignments are based upon the offense for which you were convicted, but it might help you get your petition granted. So that's two different things. One of them is, when are you eligible to petition for removal? Remember, Tier 1 is after 10 years if you were convicted of a felony as an adult. Tier 2 is 20 years. Tier 3 right now is lifetime. But I don't think a 1203.4 or a certificate of rehabilitation, for that matter, will change your tier assignment. But I think when it comes time to consider your petition for removal from the registry, that's when I think it will help.
Okay. That is
Thank
correct.
You so much.
That is correct. Those are mitigating factors.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, you're welcome. Before we go on to the next call, I want to say that we have a robust website at all times. It's particularly robust right now about the tiered registry, and the reason is we have two articles on the website about the tiered registry. One of them is factual. It says, okay, the tiered registry is now effective, and it gives some basic information about that. The other one that has 120 comments on it right now, the other one that has 274 comments as of right now, is called the California Tiered Registry Experiences. And so we have individuals who are adding comments to the website about their experiences here with the tiered registry. Remember, folks, we're only talking about 2 weeks. So in 2 weeks, we have 274 comments. But what I'm trying to suggest to you, what I am suggesting to you, is go to the website of the Alliance. And the website address is this. It's www.allall4conso.laws.org. So allforconso.laws.org, and you will look at the website. We have basic information here about the tiered registry. We have basic information here about international travel. We have basic information about a lot of things, including domestic travel. So if you go to the Alliance's website, you'll find a lot of basic information. And I want you to know that I look at the website at least once a day, and I try to steer people away from misinformation. I just give the benefit of the doubt to anybody who adds a comment to the website that they mean well, but every once in a while we've got somebody who says something that's blatantly wrong, in which case I let folks know it's wrong and tell you what the law says instead. But anyway, it's also a way for a lot of people to vent. And so sometimes that's what this is about, too. And by the way, here's an example about the benefit of adding a comment to the Axol website. After I saw several comments from people in Long Beach being told that they were not going to be provided their tier assignment, I contacted the city of Long Beach and talked to the registration officer there. And then when I talked to the registration officer, I was very troubled by what she had to say. And so I contacted the California Department of Justice. We'll see if it bears fruit next week. I certainly hope so. But I just want to let you know that when comments are made on the website, Chance and I pay attention to them, and action is taken based upon comments. So again, the website address is www.allall4conso.laws.org. And oh, by the way, when you're there, how about donating a few dollars? And the fact is, our organization is run by volunteers, including Chance and I, and the money that's donated helps us to fight things like the proposed SORNA regulations. It helps us to correct the California Department of Justice here in its implementation of the tiered registry, and so much more. So please, if you think there's any value to these calls that Chance and I participate in, you know, anything else that we do in providing a website, please make a donation, and every dollar makes a difference. Thank you.
Let me just add to that before Janice goes on, because I want to say something. You have the best advocate in the whole entire world right here on this phone. Janice is leading the way, not here, but across the nation. And, you know, if everybody just pitched in just a little bit, it would help her and our efforts to do whatever we need to do on your behalf. So, you know, donations are important, more important to support this cause, because this is a cause for justice. And she is leading that cause. And if you believe in what she's doing, and you know that it's right, do the right thing, support her and our efforts, and just thank you. Thank you for being on this call, and I know many of you do that, but we just need all the support we can get.
All right, Janice.
All right. Thank you, Chance. One other way you can support the organization, by the way, is buy a copy of the book that I mentioned earlier in this call. And the name of the book, one more time, is Show Up, Stand Up, and Speak Up, my mantra. And just a phrase that I came up with about 10 years ago, and I keep repeating because it's really important to show up, speak up, and show up, stand up, and speak up. And your participation today is showing up. So you've done the first of these things, speaking up for the callers, certainly, and, you know, standing up as well. And one other way you can do that is by donating. But the name of the book, again, is to Show Up, Stand Up, and Speak Up. It's available on Amazon, both in Kindle form, but also if you want a printed book for your bookshelf, hopefully you'll read it as well. It's available to you, and the proceeds from the sale of that book, all the profits go to the organization. So let's go ahead and go to the next call.
Yes, I'm going to call on caller ending in the four numbers of 0764. Caller, please go ahead.
Yes, Janice and Chance. As a federal Tier 1 registrant at the moment, whose crime has been assigned to a state equivalent, 243.4, can that 243.4 be reduced to a misdemeanor? That's my first question. The second question is, are all crimes for federal that's been assigned to 243.4 are being assigned the category to be determined?
I don't know the answer to that question. The other folks that I have communicated with in the past 2 weeks were convicted of the state offense, 243.4. So who is why do you think that the federal offense that, for which you were convicted is the equivalent of a 243.4? I'm not challenging
because
I'm just curious.
I received a letter from the Department of Justice back about 10 years ago, the
All
letter
right.
from the Department of Justice designated my crime as a 243.4 equivalent, state equivalent. However, I'm a federal registrant with a Tier 1 registration at the moment. The crime occurred way back in 1995.
Okay, stop. Why do you think you're a Tier 1 registrant? And again, I'm not challenging you. I'm just curious.
Well, I've been registered once a year for the last 23 years.
That makes no difference. Up to this point, we've not had tiers. So I'm not sure that you're on Tier 1. Have you gotten a tier assignment letter yet, sir?
No, I have not. My point is that I understand that a Tier 1 register once a year, and I've been registering once a year for the last 23 years.
Yeah, this is part of the misinformation here. This is kind of an apple and orange thing. California has certain requirements under PC 290 as to when a person registers. People, you know, it's usually annually, and if you're transient, it's every 30 days or so forth. It has nothing to do with tier assignment. And the second part is that you have a federal if you have a federal conviction and it's equivalent to a sexual battery, it's still a felony, You know, it may be this is something we mentioned before. It may be characterized as such, as a misdemeanor sexual battery, but it's still on the felony level. And so it'd be interesting to see exactly what your tier assignment is. You should request your agency, the place you register at, you should request them for an assignment letter.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, I'm going to call on caller ending in 42. 30. Please go ahead.
Well, hi. I have a 311, so I assume I'll be on Tier 3. And does that mean I'm also listed on I'll still be listed on the Megan website? And also, what are the chances we can get the 311s reduced to Tier 1 someday?
That's definitely a chance question. Remember, Chance is a criminal defense attorney, and I'm a civil rights attorney. So, Chance, you have a lot more experience with 311.
Okay, I'd be happy to take a shot at this. you're not giving us enough information. It's a conviction for illegal images. Is it a felony?
Right. It's a felony, yeah.
Okay. Well, felony 311s right now are up in Tier 3. This is exactly what we're talking about. This is has to do with a lot of inequities about this tiered system. As far as we know, and we've been told, it's not state and law, but we've been told that misdemeanor 311s, and to be precise, 311.11As, should be in Tier 1, where most misdemeanors should reside. Are we going to work to address the inequity there? Janice is doing that right now, and I think she can tell you about that.
Okay, so but I'm still going to be in Tier 3 and also listed on the Megan website then for now.
It appears that that's your current status. This is why Janice is getting together this litigation. This is what we're addressing is the inequities of this particular thing. We're addressing right now misdemeanors, but we're also addressing the idea of an off-ramp. And the inequities, the total inequities of putting some offenses in one place and other offenses in another. So we've got a lot of work to do here.
Okay.
So, Chance, maybe this is a good time. Thank you for your question, sir. But this might be a time for us to address briefly the whole issue of equal protection, because this is something that is definitely prevalent in the tiered registry law. So in this case, I'm not talking about how DOJ is implementing the tiered registry law, but the law itself. So the law itself was amended at the last minute, and all the CP offenses, whether it was possession, distribution, or creation, they were all put on Tier 3, the highest tier, which makes no sense to me. So most of the folks on Tier 3 were convicted of a serious and or a violent sex offense. Those are Tier 3. But then they took people convicted of a non-contact, non-violent offense and put them on Tier 3. It's not logical. And so, we believe that there's a legal argument to be made here with regard to the tiered, putting CP offenses on Tier 3. By the way, as bad as SORNA regulations are, and I quite frankly think legally and personally that they're terrible, SORNA regulations treat CP offenses differently. And so that's one of those things. CP offenses under SORNA are either on Tier 1 or Tier 2. Now, this is of the federal law, right? We're not talking about California state law. So when we have been lobbying here in Sacramento to get the CP offenses moved off of Tier 3, off the highest tier, and moved to lower tiers. All right. So, Chance, I think this might be the time to share a very personal experience I had about this. And remember, I said earlier, and it bears repeating to say it often, that the legislature itself chose to move all the CP offenses up to Tier 3. They did not consult us ahead of time. We found out, like everybody else, the rest of the public, after it happened, but there was a political compromise made, and this often happens in legislatures. It stinks, okay? And decisions are being made for no rational, logical reason. They're just getting made. And that's what happened here. And we have been told, and we have evidence to back it up, that law enforcement was behind this political compromise. In other words, they asserted pressure on a certain legislator to make sure that the CP offenses ended up in Tier 3. After that happened, I went into the office of the LA District Attorney. And by the way, the LA District Attorney helped us get the tiered registry law passed, the former DA of Los Angeles County. There's a new one now. But when I went into the lobbyist's office and said, gosh gee whiz, we worked together on getting the tiered registry law passed. Now let's work together to get the CP offenses off of Tier 3. And this is what I was told. If you even try to do that, we will crush you. Now, the person who said that did not identify who we were, was, is, or how they were going to crush, and I didn't know if it was me personally or the organization, but I want you to know that threat was made to me, to my face, and I remember it. And you know what? I've also chosen to ignore it. And ever since that time, our organization has gone forward, and we have tried to get the CP offenses off of Tier 3, and we will continue to do that until we are successful. So I want everybody to know that I'm stating this on the record in a recording, that we will continue doing this until we are successful. And guess what, folks? It took us almost 7 years to get a tiered registry law. Almost 7 years. It may take us 7 years or longer to get the CP offenses off of Tier 3. But just mark my words, we will continue doing this, whatever we need to do, to get the CP offenses off of Tier 3. Chance, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I would. I would like to say they just don't belong there. There's no rhyme or reason for it. It's completely illogical. And, you know, they just don't belong there, as other sections don't as well, but especially these. And even the federal government, which is the harshest of all in terms of how they treat, you know, sex offenses, would have them in the first tier. So, just in general, the general thought, you know, is that they don't belong there. Why California puts them there, I have no idea, but we're all dedicated to having them removed from that tier and put in the appropriate place.
So thank you for your question, caller. Mike, next caller, please.
Okay, Janice, we do have one other caller. Caller ending in 2402, please go ahead with your call.
Hello, Janice and Chance. My question is, for those of us that have been placed in a tier-to-be-determined category, presumably because we have an out-of-state conviction, would it be helpful at all to try to send in anything like successful completion of probation or treatment, or the fact that we might have been sensed as a youthful offender? Would it help to provide any information as far as for them to determine the category at all?
I don't know, but this is what I do know, that the fact that you were put in the to be determined category does not prevent you from submitting a petition. And you just said something that's very interesting, which is, I think you said that you were tried as a juvenile. Is that what you just said?
Well, the state of Florida, youthful offender, ages 18 to 24, so I was 19 years old, so it wasn't necessarily mm-hmm. a juvenile, but...
No, but often our state government treats people, you know, in similar programs. I helped somebody who was convicted not in Florida, but a third state, right? And mm-hmm. they said, oh, okay, well, he was convicted as a juvenile, even though I think he was 20 years old at the time. So it would be worth trying. But if I were you, I would go ahead and petition for removal this year or whenever, whenever you're 10 years, 20 years is up, plus remember the birthday rule, the month of your birthday. But having a to-be-determined letter, folks, should not prevent you from petitioning for a removal. And I've sent a letter to California Department of Justice basically challenging them on that and also saying, if you will not change your position on this, we will sue you. So stay tuned, read the website, because we're serious about this. There's nothing in the law that says that they can make you wait. So if you're otherwise eligible, and this is, sir, if you call me on 818-305-5984, I'd be happy to talk to you specifically. But based upon the information you've provided to me so far, I would go ahead and submit a petition when you're eligible and just disregard that letter from DOJ.
Okay, thank you.
You're certainly welcome. So, Mike, do we have any other callers right now?
We do have one from Southern California. I'll take the number 1129. I think we've heard from this person.
Yes, hi, it's me again, David. I would like to extend the appeal that both you and Chance have made, and I would like to extend it to all of the listeners with two suggestions. Listeners, please, this is very important to support Axel, to support the Alliance. You can arrange to have your bill payer contribute a small amount every month. That's how I do it. It's really easy. The check goes out every month. I don't even have to think about it, but you're supporting Axel. So please keep that in mind. And the second thing is, and I think this is very important, please be aware that lots of folks may be registrants who you have no idea about. Last time I went in to register in person, which seems like a million years ago, thanks to the pandemic, there was a woman there who was registering who I, you know, just by looks and appearance, I would never have known or thought would have been a registrant. So if you know any registrants, if you know any other registrants, please pass along the word about Axel and about them getting involved. Because as much as Axel needs, would appreciate additional supporters financially, we would sure benefit from having a lot more registrants on board. So when we go to the Capitol to address lawmakers, there's a lot of us. We need lots of voices. And the more of us that are on board, the more that we will be listened to and heard and have some effect. So everyone, please, you know, reach out to fellow registrants if you can and get them on board. All right, that's my appeal.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it.
You bet.
We have one more caller at this time on the line. Caller ending in the numbers 7340. Please go ahead.
Hi, Janice. I just didn't know if you were aware of this when you were talking about what happened at the LA District Attorney. When we were lobbying in Sacramento with you the year before, when we were in a certain assembly person's office, she said to us at the table, the only reason that LA supported the tiered registry was because they were tired of having to take every new sex offense to trial. And by having this tier registry, it was their bargaining chip by saying, okay, we'll plea deal with you and you'll only have to be on there for 10 years versus last time no one would plea deal, I guess, because it was lifetime. Did you know that?
No, that's new information. Thank you for sharing it.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. So folks, I think that bears repeating, but basically the reason that the Los Angeles District Attorney, the former LA District Attorney, supported our cause was not because she believes in our civil rights or any other reason. It's because she thought they had too many people that had to register and basically that it was costing her and her office too much money. So take that for, you know, whatever you think it's worth, that comment, but it certainly wasn't out of the goodness of her heart. And, oh, by the way, she's been replaced, and we don't know about the new DA of Los Angeles. He's saying some very positive things about criminal justice reform. Sometimes, however, when people talk about criminal justice reform, they don't want to extend it to people on the registry. So, okay, so let's move on. I think we really need to move on to travel, both domestic and overseas. And Chance, if you could start that conversation, I'm going to hang up because I'm having a little problem with my phone and I can't adjust the volume. So if you would go ahead and get that started and I'll hang up and join you all soon.
Sure. Okay. So you're welcome. So let's start with domestic travel. Domestic travel involves travel within the United States and or its territories. And international travel is anything outside the United States. So that's the first thing to know. Now let's start with domestic travel.
Domestic travel isn't within
your particular state. It's from state to state. This is what we're talking about. There are certain rules each state has as far as their in-state categories of visitation, and what we're really talking about here is crossing state lines and going to other states. And the thing to remember as far as domestic travel is concerned is, you know, you need to check out what the requirements are of the states that you're going to visit, because if you're registered, let's just say in California and you're going to Nevada, you are an out-of-state registrant visiting the state of Nevada,
and there are certain rules and regulations and requirements, and that goes for all the states and territories of the United States of America. So that's the first issue. Second, and I won't even get to international travel yet. I'll just deal with that. But is there any questions about domestic travel? Anybody?
I don't see any hands. Star, call in and 5-star if you have a question.
Okay, none?
None so far.
Okay, so, all right, domestic travel is pretty simple. The rules of the road are this. You know, do not register in any other state. You know, if you're a Californian, you register in California. Stay registered in California. Do not register in any other state. If you have to register in Nevada and you've got 24 hours to do it, stay there less than 24 hours. Know the rules and regulations of the state. Know what the cumulative is of visitation if you're going to go more than once, and understand what you need to do to avoid registration, which means don't stay there long enough to register. Okay. Yes.
I'll just interrupt you for a second. We do have a couple callers, so you need to know that whenever you're ready to take a call.
Okay, sure.
And Chance, want you to know that I'm back online. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. Excellent. So, before we take any callers, and Janice, I think you probably heard the tail end of that. Anything more you want to say about domestic travel? I've discussed, one, what it entails, which is state-to-state travel. Two, each jurisdiction has its requirements. Three, rules of the road, which is don't register in any other state because it will complicate things for you. Stay registered only to the state of the original jurisdiction. If you visit other states, again, make sure you know the requirements, the cumulative requirements, whatever it takes to avoid registration, and comply with that. Janice?
Yeah, Chance, I think the only thing that I would add would be specific concerns with two states, and those are the states of Florida and New York. So I think there's some other states out there, but for sure, Florida and New York, if you are ever required to register in those two states, you will be on the registry for the rest of your life. And so think about it from the perspective of the tiered registry. If you are required to register in the state of New York, for example, and you get off the California registry, you're still a registrant for the purposes of the International Megan's Law and other reasons. And so you will not, you know, under IML, if you are one of the covered, quote, sex offenders, you're still a covered sex offender because they are registering you in the state of New York. So absolutely, I support what Chance says.
Okay, so that goes back to rules of the road, which is don't register in any other state. So, good. So callers?
We have one caller right now. You might have answered the question of the other one. I'm going to take caller in 0656. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Joe again. Since it was so quiet there, I thought perhaps it would be important for people to understand that there is a link on our website to a chart that has information on all the different registration requirements for the states that people can go to check out information.
Very good. Very good. And one caveat is that information does not stay static. It's dynamic, which means that you as a foundational answer, go to it, but also follow up to see if any changes in that particular state have been made once you recognize what the requirements are.
Yes, and thank you, Joe, for bringing that up. I want to call people's attention to its specific location on the website. So if you look at the homepage of the website, up on the top there are many different tabs, about 8 or 10 of them, and one of them is legal. So if you click on the legal tab on the home page, what's going to happen is there's a drop-down menu, and it will tell you about the laws in the 50 states and territories,
But as Chance just said, things change pretty rapidly. And so I know that we're in need of an update here. So use that as a starting point. So, for example, we tell you the specific law, the section of the law that requires registration in that particular state. You need to go look at that. And if you really can't figure it out, give us a call here at the organization. And again, the phone number is 818-305-5984, 818-305-5984. So, Mike, do we have any more callers at this point?
Not at this time.
Okay, so let's go ahead and address these other issues. I know one of our callers asked about being buried in a federal cemetery, and I'm very sad to report that if you're on the registry at this point in time, you cannot be buried in a federal cemetery, even if you are a retiree from the military. And in addition to that, that's terrible and awful. And in addition to that, at this point in time, people who are on the registry are not even allowed to join the military. So that's as bad as it is. We have a former U.S. Senator. Her name is Barbara Boxer, if you all remember her and her name. And it's because of Barbara Boxer, in part. I think she was misinformed. I hope that was what it was based upon. But that's one of the things, certainly, that we need to change. And again, people, certainly people who, you know, spend an entire career in the military, and how dare the federal government then deny them the right, not even a privilege, but a right to be buried in a federal cemetery. So I think that's all that needs to be said about this. Let's go ahead and move on to the topic of COVID-19 issues. We have been working diligently to convince registration offices not to register people in person. It only is self-evident, right, that if there's a pandemic going on, that people should not be required to come into an office with a whole lot of other people. You know, for example, we've been told by the governor to stay in place. And, you know, stay in our home unless we had to go out to buy groceries or you know, go to a pharmacy. So, good grief. Why in the world would you be required then to go in to an office to register? I will commend the city of Los Angeles. I have commended them. I continue to commend them for their decision early on. In fact, I believe they did it in late February or early March, where they basically told registrants, do not come here. And they closed their lobbies right away. And they said, instead of coming in person to register, you can do this by phone call. Wow, right? Who would have thought that you could actually use a telephone to register? But they've been doing it successfully now for at least 9 months. And guess what? There aren't a bunch of, you know, new sex offenses taking place in Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles. Other places have been not as cooperative, and what I mean by that is that, you know, they're registering people in the parking lot or somewhere outdoors. Thankfully, in California, we have decent enough weather most of the year that can be accomplished. And then there are a few, I would just call them knuckleheads, who, despite the governor's executive order that was issued in May, that they are still requiring people to come in to register, still taking photographs, and still taking fingerprints. And of course, especially the fingerprint process also always involves somebody touching you, right? And I don't know about you all, but I'm doing my best not to be touched by a stranger, and certainly not anybody outside my immediate family. So, you know, I'd say we've had mostly positive results here. And if anybody who's listening to this, either as a live conversation or recorded, please call 818-305-5984. That's our switchboard, 818-305-5984. And we'll call you back to talk to you about a challenge you might be facing. We can't promise you that we can get them, your local registration office, to change completely, but we're going to do our best to get as many to change their ways as possible. And by the way, honest to God, the governor of this state of California issued an executive order on May 8th of last year that encouraged not require, but encourage registration offices not to register people in person and told them specifically how to register them otherwise. So there's a DOJ information bulletin dated May 12th, just 4 days after the governor's executive order, and it tells the offices precisely how to do this without, you know, photographs and without fingerprints. Chance, is there something else you'd like to add to that?
No, that's well covered. Thank you. Perfect.
You're welcome. We also filed a lawsuit with regard to COVID involving prisoners, and I don't know about you all, but I keep reading these stories about how widely spread COVID is in prisons. In California in particular, people were taken from one prison that had COVID to another prison that didn't have COVID and spread COVID through that second prison. I believe that the secretary of CDCR basically was asked to resign because of that mistake he made, but he still made the mistake. And guess what? San Quentin, I think, still has the record in California for prisons as the highest rate of infection. So that is not a rate anybody wants. We did file our one lawsuit and had limited success with it. Actually, a judge in Los Angeles County dismissed the case. And it was really upsetting to me because at that time, the judge wasn't in the courtroom. I wasn't in the courtroom, and my opposing counsel wasn't in the courtroom because of COVID and our concern that we might get infected with COVID if we were in the courthouse. And everybody understood that, but yet they wouldn't understand that a prisoner who was in a much different environment, right, basically crammed into a cell with many other people, be cause for concern. And I thought they were being extremely hypocritical. And I know I even sent opposing counsel a video from Trevor Howard, I believe it was, Noah Trevor, about COVID spreading throughout prisons rapidly. And I didn't get a response to that. But anyway, COVID is an issue. I'm hoping here and praying, quite frankly, that soon vaccines will be available to prisoners and to prison staff, quite frankly, because they're all working and the prison staff's working in tight quarters. The prisoners are living in tight quarters. They have it, of course, even more exposure, and that all those people get vaccinated as soon as possible. Chance, anything that you want to add?
No, other than, this was a foreseeable problem, it is just horrendous the way that jails and prisons are being torn up by this. So it's a big concern for us.
It didn't need to happen. It just didn't need to happen. And by the way, there have been some early release programs in the prisons for people like who are particularly vulnerable or who are in high-risk categories. And what do you know CDCR keeps doing? They keep excluding people convicted of a sex offense from that. So I think that's unconscionable myself. We are addressing it. By the way, there are many other much larger organizations with a lot more resources, like the ACLU, who are fighting the cases now with prisoners. And so once our case was dismissed, we didn't file another one because we saw that ACLU and the larger organizations have weighed in. So why don't I go ahead and move on to Proposition 57 as a topic. And to remind you all, the public overwhelmingly passed Proposition 57, which basically gave prisoners some rights. And the one that was most interest to us is it basically said that anybody convicted of a nonviolent offense, would receive early consideration for parole. It didn't say they were going to get early parole. It said they were going to be considered for parole early. And what does that mean, a parole hearing? Okay, so lo and behold, when the Department of Corrections issued the regulation, its regulations implementing Proposition 57, it created out of the air an exception. An exception was, except for anybody who's ever been convicted of a sex offense. That's not what the ballot proposition said, folks. It just said anybody convicted of a nonviolent offense. So we sued CDCR, and pardon me, we sued them because of their emergency regulations that had the exclusion in it. And then we sued them a second time because of their final regulations that had a similar exclusion. But basically, anybody who was ever convicted of a sex offense. So we had people who are in prison right now because of, let's just say, Grand Theft Auto, but because they were convicted of a sex offense 30 years ago, they were being denied and still are being denied early parole consideration. So we filed the two lawsuits. The first lawsuit with the emergency regulations is still pending before the state Supreme Court because there's another case that was ahead of that. And that case that was ahead of it is called Gadlin, G-A-D as in dog, L-I-N, Gadlin. And I had the opportunity to get appointed by the court to be Mr. Gadlin's attorney. The unfortunate circumstances are Mr. Gadlin's original attorney, Michael Satris, died unexpectedly of a heart attack. And all of a sudden, the case needed a new attorney. And I was nominated to be the new attorney, in part because I had helped Mr. Satris with the Gadlin case in the form of a friend of the court brief, an amicus brief. So I was waiting in line with the Alliance case, but all of a sudden I jumped to the front of the line representing Mr. Gadlin. And on October 7th of last year, I argued my first case before the state Supreme Court, and that was the Gadlin case. And I'm happy to report that I won. So we are really happy about that. And it's going to help a lot of people that, in fact, are currently in custody and who were being denied early parole consideration. Having said that, there are still cases pending, a couple of cases before the Supreme Court. We have one in here in Sacramento Superior Court that's pending before a judge. In fact, I was supposed to have a hearing yesterday in Sacramento Superior Court on the second Axol case against CDCR, and the judge vacated the hearing and that basically is giving CDCR one more time to basically explain to the judge why they think that the decision in Gadlin doesn't apply to them. So I want you to know that it does apply to them, that the Gadlin decision from the state Supreme Court was very broad. Okay, and so it applies to people who are currently in prison because of a sex offense conviction, as well as people who are currently in custody for a different reason, but who have a prior sex offense. So having said that, please understand that it may take some time, CDCR may take some time in revising their regulations. All right, so it's not over yet. I've gotten several phone calls already about it. And the decision, by the way, was issued on December 28th, so it's pretty new still, less than a month old. And the state Supreme Court told CDCR that its regulations violated the Constitution, and therefore CDCR had to rewrite their regulations. And to reflect that, you know, any person convicted of a nonviolent offense would be considered early for parole. I hope that CDCR does not drag its feet in this regard. I'm not sure what we can do if they do drag their feet. I've warned people it could take up to a year for CDCR to issue its new regulations implementing Proposition 57. And I've asked people, you know, who this might provide them some relief to be patient. And I think that'll end there. Chance, I don't know if there's something you might want to add about Prop 57 or the litigation.
Oh, no. No, I think that's it. Pretty comprehensive.
All right. So, folks, if you do have a question or comment about Prop 57 or the decision from the state Supreme Court, this is the time to press 5 and then the star key. Again, we're talking about Prop 57 and the requirement that CDCR provide early parole consideration for anybody convicted of a nonviolent offense. And I guess I would like to add that in California, only 9 sex offenses are considered violent offenses, 9. And that surprises a lot of people, including me, quite frankly, but the number is 9. And the law enforcement
lobby effort organization, they tried to get that change through a ballot proposition in November of last year. And our ballot proposition number was 22. And when I first read ballot proposition 22, I didn't think we had a chance in heck to defeat it. But guess what? It was defeated. And it would have significantly increased the number of violent offenses overall, and also for registrants in particular, and it would have caused a lot of problems. And chances, you know well, as a criminal defense attorney, if something's considered a violent offense, you get longer sentences, is that right? And other repercussions.
That's correct. Enhancements and all kinds of stuff.
So it's not terrible. Yeah, but folks, we helped to defeat Proposition 22. I mean, I'm patting myself on the back here because we got the word out that Proposition 22 was bad and people needed to vote no. It was on our website for a long time, and I even had the opportunity, I'm going to call it, to speak to the one of the local Chambers of Commerce about this, and it was pretty interesting because I think they thought that I was going to be some, you know, crazy liberal frothing at the mouth and, you know, beating on my chest and say, just do the right thing. But and I probably said some of those things, but in addition to saying those things, I quoted chapter and verse from a wonderful report that had been issued by another nonprofit that talked about the financial cost of passing Proposition 22. And I mean, it would have been millions, tens of millions of dollars statewide. And for each county, it broke it down for each county, how much it would cost every single year if in fact ballot Proposition 22 passed. So I'd like to think that I played some small part in convincing that county not to vote in favor of Proposition 22. Quite frankly, I don't care because the overall result was that 22 was defeated. And I do think we're in a new environment here, folks, and an environment where criminal justice reform is actually getting some respect, and that people, I think that we can get attention to even the tiered registry law here that we might not have gotten in the past, and correct some of these big problems like getting those CP offenses off of Tier 3. That's my commercial. Chance, do you want to add to it before we go on?
No, I support the efforts, that's for sure.
Yeah, thank you. And you have literally supported the effort. You have come to Sacramento many times. You've helped us lobby in support of changing the tiered registry law, and I thank you for that. And thank you, David and Marty and other people who have been able to join us here in Sacramento. And if you haven't been here in person, you've written letters and made phone calls, because those things really do make a difference. And I'll just give you a brief scenario. You know, for us to walk into a legislative office and say, hi, we're here to meet with staffer so-and-so about this topic, the tiered registry law, and the person at the front desk goes, oh, gosh, we've gotten a lot of calls about that. That is a perfect scenario. You know, instead of, oh, yeah, sure, you know, let the person know you're here. But for them to tell us right away that they've gotten a lot of calls about this issue, it certainly makes me smile. Do we have any callers right now, Mike, who are waiting?
We have one caller.
Excellent.
5158, please go ahead with your call.
Hi, I put on the previous thing. I'll do quickly. They did not fingerprint when I went for registration, and when they had me. Okay. There was a handler. They just did a thumbprint, but the person stepped away, and I just did the thumbprint on my own. And then, if you get time to cover, I thought you gave some hope last time that ex post facto had some future hope of being reversed. And if there is nothing on that, that's fine. Thanks. Pass.
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, there is a case recently issued by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on that. Thank you. I'll talk about that next. Well, actually, I got one other topic to cover first, and then we'll go to that next. Because somebody asked me about jurors being on a jury.
Okay, so let's go forward then about the jurors. There was a lovely piece of legislation here in Sacramento that was going through, and it was, and everybody was saluting it, and all it was getting passed in all the committees, and was well on its way to becoming law. And at the very last minute, one legislator stopped it. And I've mentioned her name before, and I'll mention it again. Her name is Lorena Gonzalez Fletcher, and Lorena, I'll just refer to her by first name. Lorena is from San Diego. I can't tell anybody how to vote, and she just got reelected, so it'll be a while before she's up for reelection again. But the fact is, she added an exception to that law, and the exception was unless you were convicted of a sex offense. So quite literally, if you are convicted of murder, you can serve on a jury, but if you are convicted of public indecency, you cannot. So that makes absolutely no sense to me. And we have filed now two lawsuits, one in Los Angeles County and the other one in Alameda County. And the first case was dismissed, unfortunately, in Los Angeles County. The judge, quite frankly, is afraid of this issue. She was afraid. And she when she said, is this a case of first impression? And once we said yes, she ran in the opposite direction as fast as she could. So we lost the case in Los Angeles. The case in Alameda County is still pending, and we do have a hearing in the case pretty soon on February 2nd. So I hope that the folks in Alameda County are more broad-minded than this one judge in Los Angeles County. We shall see. And then if not, we will have to decide whether or not to appeal the judge's decision. So that's where we are with regard to jurors and whether or not a person on the registry can be excluded from jury service solely because he is on the registry. So why don't I go ahead and ask for questions or comments if you press 5 and the star key. And I know our fellow board member David asked me to discuss this topic. I guess that's because he wants to serve on a jury. but anyway, I mean, I've had people on the registry tell me they don't want to be on a jury, and it's okay with them that they got this exception. But I believe that, quite frankly, that people should not be excluded just because they're on the registry. Some people look at it as a duty. Some people look at it as a right. However you look at it, I hope you know that we're fighting for the ability for you to serve on a jury. And then, you know, if you could be excluded for another reason, of course, it wouldn't affect that. So 5 and the star key. And why don't I just go ahead to the final topic here, because it is a really important one, and I thank you, caller, for bringing it up. There is a case out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The case is called John and Jane Doe's, plural, 1 through 134. So there are 134 plaintiffs in this case. And basically, it's against the Attorney General in the state of Idaho, whose last name is Wasden, W-A-S-D-E-N. So the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals basically told the federal district court where the original case was filed that they improperly dismissed the case. So, again, what happened is this case was filed in federal district court. The federal district court said, I don't think so. We don't want to hear this case, and dismissed the entire case. That case was taken on appeal up to the Ninth Circuit, which is just one level below the U.S. Supreme Court. And sure enough, the Ninth Circuit said, not so fast, district court, and basically remanded the case back to the district court. This decision only came out in December, and so, and again, it's called Doe's, plural, versus Wasden, W-A-S-D-E-N. The reason that I'm so excited about this opinion is that perhaps, and please underline the word perhaps in your memory or if you're taking notes, perhaps the Ninth Circuit is signaling to us and the rest of the world that they might reconsider their past decisions, plural, about ex post facto claim consideration. And what I mean by that, I hope you all are aware of the U.S. Supreme Court decision that was made in 2003. That case is called Smith versus Doe. And in Smith versus Doe, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that being on the registry was not punishment. So I don't agree with that statement. I'm going to guess if you're listening to this, you don't agree with it either, and try not to throw your phone across the room. But that, in anger, that's what I did the first time I read it. But the fact is that the U.S. Supreme Court said because registration was an administrative requirement and not punishment, that the ex post facto clause could not be, it was not triggered, and therefore that new sex offender laws could be passed and applied retroactively. And folks, this has hurt so many people, especially in states like California and every state where there's a lifetime registry, because what happens is new laws keep getting passed and applied retroactively. So way back when you entered into a plea deal, most people did, not everybody, but most people did, you had no idea that it was going to limit where you could work, where you could live, who you could date, you know, whether or not you could go to the dog park or the beach, et cetera, et cetera. So this case, Doe versus Wasden out of the state of Idaho, there's some indication here that maybe the Ninth Circuit will disagree with the U.S. Supreme Court in Smith versus Doe. By the way, there's another case out there that was decided, oh goodness, 3 years ago, I believe, and that case is called Doe versus Snyder. And in Doe versus Snyder, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals basically declared Michigan sex offender laws to be unconstitutional because they said, taken all together, all the sex offender laws in the state of Michigan were punishing and therefore punishment, and therefore they could not be applied retroactively. Brilliant decision. I loved that decision. I wept when I read it the first time because I was so happy, and it certainly reflected many of the arguments that Chance and I and other attorneys have been making for a long time. The state of Michigan right now is a mess, as far as I'm concerned, and they haven't gotten complete relief from that decision, but oh well. So back to this decision, again, it appears to me that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is giving an indication, a signal, that they might be willing to reconsider, not necessarily reverse themselves, on the issue of whether or not sex offender laws, plural, constitute punishment. So that's why I'm so encouraged by this decision. There's a little hiccup here, though, I want to tell you. And I'm going to read you one paragraph from this decision. Remember, this is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals saying this. And here it goes. It says, this is a difficult case, made all the more so by appellants John and Jane Doe's woefully inadequate briefing. They're talking about the lawyers. They're not talking about the plaintiffs here. Despite repeated reprimands below, the Doe's attorney continues to require the court to parse through pages upon pages of allegations to decipher their actual arguments on appeal. And here comes the really telling statement. Indeed, when reading the Doe's brief, the plaintiff's brief, and the record below, one wonders if they, the plaintiffs, in their own version of the spaghetti approach, have heaved the entire contents of a pot of spaghetti against the wall in hopes that something would stick. Folks, those are damning words. If Chance or I ever received a decision like this, I know I would be hanging, I'll just say it for myself. I'd be hanging my head in shame, and I might decide it's time to change careers. But the fact is, because of that language, and there's some other language as well in this decision, we, Axol, have reached out to two different avenues. One is to the attorneys themselves, the attorneys who had this case, and quite frankly, they said they were not prepared for this, okay? They don't do this on a regular basis, and what I mean by this, they don't file cases in federal court on a regular basis, and they don't do appeals on a regular basis. Oh my gosh. So they're like, we're a two-person law firm in Utah. This is them. I'm conveying what they said in summary form that, you know, this is not what we do on a regular basis. We did our best, and this is a reflection of our best, which is not very good.
as that one judge just repeated what he said. And then another thing that happened was a different board member approached the ACLU in the state of Utah and asked the ACLU if they will get involved. So this is the bottom line. Either Axel or the ACLU, or together Axel and the ACLU, will help these lawyers in the future, because this is a really important case, and most of all, we need to prevent a bad decision, right? I mean, if the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals basically says, oh, yeah, Smith versus Doe decided it all, being on the registry is not punishment, right, and therefore all these laws can be applied retroactively, that would be terrible. So we've bad enough the cases that we do have on the record in the Ninth Circuit, but anyway, and again, the way many of us attorneys are reading this decision is there's a hint of hope here that the Ninth Circuit might be willing to reconsider its position about whether or not, you know, registration requirements are punishment. How about Chance? Would you like to add to that?
Well, no. I mean, that again, that's very comprehensive about what is going on. But other than to say that there is a glimmer of hope here, and that maybe, just maybe, this will be the beginning of the end of Smith versus Doe. So, you know, who knows? I mean, it was achieved in the Sixth Circuit. Ninth Circuit is our home court. And so, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic here.
And for Chance to say that, that's a big deal. I mean, I'm an optimist by nature, and I keep, you know, pressing forward here and thinking that we're going to someday overturn Smith versus Doe. The only question for me is what day that's going to be. And I want you to know I take this very personally, and I have gone to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I'm staring at my certificate right now that says that I am qualified to argue a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. And maybe this will be the case. Maybe the Wasden case will be it. I'm not sure. But quite frankly, I'm willing to carry the briefcase of a different attorney, right, who does this. So if ACLU decides to take over and they can get this case to the U.S. Supreme Court, I'm happy to carry somebody's briefcase. But the fact is, it's absolutely important that we overturn Smith versus Doe. And, you know, both Chance and I get Smith v. Doe cited over and over again in the cases that we handle. And I know that I'm sick and tired of doing that and having to basically respond to opposing counsel's argument that, oh my goodness, you know, once a sex offender, always a sex offender. Their terminology, not mine. And Chance and I hope you know too, folks, that is nonsense. It's not supported by the facts at all. The reoffense rate for somebody on a sex offender registry is extremely low, extremely low, okay? We've got the facts, we've got the reports, and we are constantly educating the judges. This is one way I like to look at it. We're educating the judges in the lawsuits and saying, folks, these are the facts. The reoffense rate is extremely low. And most of all, I love to use CDCR's own reports against them when we sue CDCR, because CDCR has written in multiple reports that the reoffense rate, please write this down, the reoffense rate for a registrant on parole in the state of California is less than 1%. Less than 1%. Right, and if I told you what the fraction is, you might forget the fraction, but you will remember less than 1%. And that is absolutely accurate. And so when the U.S. Supreme Court said in Smith versus Doe that the recidivism rate was, quote, frightening and high, nonsense, okay? The recidivism rate, again, if you consider things like parole violations, maybe that is true. But the reoffense rate, which is what they were really talking about, is extremely low. And by the way, the reoffense rate for people convicted of a sex offense is less than every other offense except one, and the only other offense is murder. And by the way, most people convicted of murder don't get out of prison. So
So anyway, we share this information with you because it is part of the education process. And as somebody on the registry or the family member of a registrant, you really need to have these facts at your fingertips. So when somebody says something stupid to you, like, oh gosh, you was once a sex offender, always a sex offender, you can say, that's not true. And I would suggest you pause then and let them look at you like you said the sky is falling and then give them the facts because that's what it's going to take to make a difference. Remember, that's part of show up, stand up, and speak up. Okay? But please do it in a protected way. We're not suggesting that you stand on a street corner and spout these statistics. It wouldn't be safe, okay? But perhaps when you're, in a family setting or you're talking to somebody who knows you, who's a friend, who knows who you really are, that it will make sense to them. And then, by the way, they can pass that on to other people as well. So in wrapping up this wonderful session that we've had together today, and again, this is the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. We're meeting today on January 16th of the year 2021. And we've covered a lot of territory today. If you have questions, if you need a specific question answered, please call 818-305-5984. Again, 818-305-5984. And we will answer. That would be me, Editorial We. If I don't answer the phone, please leave a voicemail message. I do my best to return phone calls. If I don't return a call within 24 hours, please feel free to call again and leave a second message. I'm a great lawyer, and I'm not such a great secretary and admin. So anyway, maybe the last thing I'll say is please consider making a donation to the Alliance. You can do it on the website. You can send us a check here to the office in Sacramento. And please also, you can help the organization by buying a copy of the book, Stand Up, Show Up, Speak Up. And that book is available on Amazon. Chance, would you like to wrap it up here?
Yeah, please. Thank you. I just want to thank everybody for joining us today. And thank you for supporting our efforts. And just thank you for standing by us and seeing us through all this. You are what we are all about. Thank you.
And with that, I bid you all adieu. Look forward to speaking with you next month in February. Take good care. Bye-bye.